Hello, Richie.
Hello, Chip.
Glad you could join us.
I'm very glad to come. And Govan was one of my old haunts time in Scotland.
Right.
I lived here.
It's not really a surprise to me. We kind of think that Govan is the centre of the universe.
Yeah.
So you must have been drawn here at some point. But you're originally from Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I grew up in County Fermanagh, in a place called Maguire's Bridge that few people have heard of outside Inniskillen. That's where I grew up. My parents, who have both died now, my mother very recently. My father was from County Cavan originally, and he was a kind of wandering farm labourer.
Aye.
Who eventually settled in County Fermanagh, met my mother, and the rest was our family history.
Aye. Obviously grown up in those times, Richie, during the Troubles, obviously, mm-hmm. and the history of that must have affected you.
Well, it certainly did in several ways, because I was too young to actively participate in the positive movements that took place in 1968, but old enough to at least have some kind of glimmering of a knowledge that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm making is that the Troubles were not inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
The Troubles were the result of a lost opportunity. In fact, I've written a pamphlet on the subject, Class Not Creed, because it affected me in several ways. One was the fact that I observed huge differences of wealth in mm-hmm. childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Even on the simplest level, I remember asking my father, why is it that there's small fields and big fields,
mm-hmm.
small farms and big farms? Now, he was a religious man, and so he tried to explain it in terms of God and creation. But even as a child, I found that puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
Even when at first I was being given religious teachings as a child, I found it very confusing that if this God was good, why it was that there were small fields and big fields in the country, the rural area that I grew up, and why it was that there were people that I perceived to be rich. Frankly, looking back on it, they weren't that rich,
mm-hmm.
but compared to us, they were.
Yeah.
And so that affected me. So I suppose what I'm saying, Jim, is that initially it was the contrast between wealth and poverty that affected me. And then when I went to secondary school in what was then called Inniskillen Technical School, it was unique because it was mixed Protestants and Catholics. That was something that deeply affected me in a positive way, because I discovered that the so-called other side were just like the rest of us,
mm-hmm, yeah.
and vice versa. And so that had a very positive effect of breaking down some of the sectarian assumptions and divisions that young people inherited from the way society had been built. And I, now that as an adult or in my later teens, I discovered that it wasn't some kind of God-given position, or it wasn't something natural bred into the people of Ireland. It was actually consciously created, that division, by those that ruled us.
Yeah.
It was divide and conquer. So that was a positive experience of going to a mixed school. And like I said, the events of 1968 were ones that I've subsequently written about and spoken on and so on. But those were occasions when ordinary people, particularly younger people actually, revolted against poverty, poor slum housing, job losses and lack of jobs, on top of which there was brutal discrimination against the Catholic minority. But the key thing was that it involved young Protestants as well as masses of young Catholics, mostly young, not exclusively. That was an opportunity for me, in my mind, I mean, for unity and socialism, because there was a ferment at the time of ideas. There was a lot of people affected by international events like France 68, the civil rights movement of the blacks in America. A lot of the Catholics identified themselves as the blacks of Ireland as a result. And it was an opportunity that was wasted by the leadership of that civil rights movement, frankly, and more particularly by the leadership of the trade union and labour movement of the time, who wasted the chance to bring people together to say, well, we want an end to discrimination, we want houses for all, we want jobs for all, but it doesn't mean you share the misery by taking them away from Protestants and giving them to Catholics.
Right.
It should have been a case of having a programme to build houses, create jobs, and ensure plenty for all, and that could have been done.
Yeah. Again, in times that we look back on, Richard, a lot of times that's we see there is positive movements.
Yeah.
But unless, as you say, we have leadership there,
that's right.
We can regress rather than move forward. Obviously, I'm thinking that when you actually left Ireland and moved to Liverpool, you were kind of in the maelstrom of politics there, weren't you?
I was indeed. I mean, I joined the Labour Party the first day I arrived in Liverpool. Well, the second day, because that was a Sunday. and I did so because at school I'd been labelled the revolutionary. Now, I didn't have a bloody clue what that meant, and probably neither did my classmates. Right. But that's what they called me, because I was prepared to speak out and thought that the world should be different. I was being influenced by observations and all that, like I said. And I joined the Labour Party because I thought that would be the vehicle to end inequality, which was the driving force in my head from personal experience, I suppose. And after a while, to cut the story shorter, I discovered that some of the people in the Labour Party were not really of that mind. They were just out for a career. And I had no real common grounds with some of them. But then I met somebody who was selling literature from the Militant at the time. Mm-hmm. And she asked me what my opinions were on Ireland and what should be done. And I'd arrived at views independently of any organisation, that what you needed was the unity of working class people in Ireland. And at the height of the troubles that this was, I felt that there should be kind of joint defence for Catholics and Protestants. And it was kind of a confused version of things that I put across. But basically, I believed that instead of sectarian division dictating, that working class people in Ireland should be united on the common issues of poverty, bad housing, discrimination as well, and all that, and that what you need was a socialist Ireland. She nearly fell off the stool because that was the policies that had been advocated, unbeknownst to me, of a group I'd never heard of in my youth called the Militant.
Yeah.
So after a while I joined that, and we were like the real socialists within the Labour Party. We were, I suppose you'd call it, the Marxist wing of the Labour Party. And eventually I became the Merseyside regional organiser and spokesperson for Militant after a time. And therefore I was involved in the maelstrom of the battles of the mid-80s against Thatcher's government.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that whole episode. In fact, it was one of the greatest periods of my political life, to be honest, because it was a movement of ordinary working class people in the city on issues that matter to them: houses, jobs, wages, nursery places for their children, combating discrimination towards black people in the population, and so on. And it was a movement that took on the Tory government and was the first really that defeated the Tory government. It preceded the battle that beat them on the poll tax and contributed to that, actually. But it was something to be really proud of, because it was involving propagating basic class struggle socialism to masses of people in meetings in school halls, community centres, on the streets, outside factory gates. I was in the middle of organising all of that and doing it as well. And it was brilliant, because it really lifted people, lifted their heads, lifted their gaze beyond the muck that they had to deal with on a daily basis, and to have a vision of something different. And the fact that we fought the Tory government and won eventually through mass strikes, one day generous strikes in the region, demonstrations of 50,000 in support of the city council, not against it, which is quite unique.
Right.
and 50,000 in a city that's smaller than Glasgow gives you an idea of the scale. And those movements forced the Tories back on their heels, because they were fighting on two fronts: the Liverpool City Council struggle and the miners' strike of the period 1984-85. They eventually beat a tactical retreat, and we won £60 million out of them for building houses, 5,000 council houses, front and back doors. Mm-hmm. I never realised how important that is until I moved to Glasgow, by the way, mm-hmm. the idea of a front and back door. But we had council houses for rent,
aye.
Not for sale and for profiteering by private landlords, but for rent of high standard. We built 5,000 of them at a time when all the councils combined across Britain built a couple of hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And we created 12,500 construction jobs to do that. We introduced a 35-hour week without loss of pay for the workforce in the council. There was about 30,000 on the workforce. We built 6 new nurseries for children, improved the education system in the schools, froze the cost of social services like, you know, meals, free meals and stuff like that, and services to the elderly. All sorts of measures like that. The rents were frozen for, I think it was something like a total of 6 years. So we fought the Tories to a standstill by mobilising the population, by mobilising working class people. And I think it will always, to my day and day, will be a proud episode, and also one that proves to me it is possible with leadership to get people to stand up on their hind legs and fight back for a better society. So it was brilliant in that respect. But of course the reward I got, amongst others, was expulsion from the Labour Party.
Neil Kinnock
yes.
behind that, yeah.
Yes. He thought, we can't have this. It sets too much of a positive socialist example. It'll spread like the plague in the Labour Party elsewhere.
And the quote I read, Richie, was you were expelled for being an effective socialist.
That's exactly my belief. He tried to put spin on it, but for being a party within a party and all this kind of stuff, and being a ringleader of it. But I appeared before the expulsion committee where he was there. I heard him mutter to Dennis Healy. No, sorry. Roy Hattersley, his deputy at the time.
Same kind of eyebrows.
Aye. He muttered, he's a good militant. And the woman who was accompanying me, because you were allowed to bring a friend to be as a kind of witness, a silent witness, she said, maybe you've got a hope of not being expelled. And I said, the opposite. That ensures expulsion because I'm too effective for his liking. But it was because he saw the way in which we were spreading the idea of defiance and socialism and workers' unity and struggle to places like Scotland included, because we had big rallies in support of the Liverpool City Council up here.
I think, and there's good linkages always between Liverpool and Glasgow.
Exactly.
As well, yeah.
So it was expelled, but as I said at the time, I might have been expelled out of the Labour Party, but it was never expelled out of the working class. I remained a part of it.
Yeah.
And so got me comeuppance in the continued struggle for socialism and trade union rights and so on.
It's all about learning, Richard.
Aye.
But I heard a great quote this week for Ian Blackford of the SNP, saying that there was a shiver ran through the Tory benches and couldn't find their spine to crawl up. I thought that was a fantastic line.
Yes.
And it really, that defines the lack of leadership. But for people to say, this is what I believe in, and stand up and persist in standing up, no changing their mind every 5 minutes, depending on
precisely.
I
mean, if you have no fixed principles, you'd be blown around with the winds of change and passing whims and fancies in the population.
Yeah.
And so I think that the Labour Party has been cursed by leaders of that kind. Mm-hmm. I mean, what leaders in quote marks?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're people who will go with what they perceive as the tide at the time for popular votes.
Yeah.
You had Kinnock, who in his youth was a left-winger, seen as a bit of a firebrand socialist, to use the old cliche. I took great pleasure at the expulsion meeting, by the way, of quoting arguments about it's not just enough to nationalise big industries and banks. You need workers' control and workers' management. Otherwise, it's not socialism. And it was one of my flourishes and finales in the expulsion defence speech. And I rammed it down Kinnock's throat by pointing it was him that had said that in his youth. But then he began to bend to defeats that had been suffered. He helped to create them. He betrayed the likes of the miners' struggle, as well as the Liverpool struggle at the time. He betrayed it by his absence and then his denunciations. And instead of giving leadership and spreading the struggle and spreading solidarity, as did the TUC leadership, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when the miners were defeated, people like Kinnock was reinforced in his gloom about the inability of working people to fight back. and he created invented phrases like New Realism to describe that. And of course, every time he said it's impossible, class struggle is an old-fashioned idea from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Every time he said that, it reinforced the setbacks for working people because they weren't given a leadership. Mm-hmm. And so you get these leaders. He paved the way. He was the John the Baptist for Jesus Christ Blair, really, who paved the pathway for that traitor who, well, in fact, he wasn't really a traitor. He was true to himself. Right. He was always a Tory in Labour clothing, Blair. And he, of course, made Labour into an openly, nakedly, unashamedly capitalist party. Mm-hmm. He removed all the vestiges of socialist aims from the Labour Party, which was set up by trade unions and working people and socialists a century ago to pursue socialism, mm-hmm. but always had a capitalist wing who actually were the dominant one in leadership. But Blair was the pinnacle of that. And he then, I suppose it was right when Maggie Thatcher said her greatest legacy was Tony Blair, mm-hmm. because he took up the ideas that she represented in reality and made Labour into a second capitalist party in a kind of undiluted form, mm-hmm. which was a complete change from the past when it was a mixture of socialists and trade unions on the one hand and capitalist or pro-capitalist elements at the top. Labour became just straightforwardly another mm-hmm. capitalist party, mm-hmm. and that helped to explain subsequent events and things I was involved in, including the setup of the SSP.
That's what I was going to say. Is that the move to Glasgow, was that maybe a chance to having learned what you'd learned there and maybe take that to fresh ground?
It was partially. I was actually asked to come initially temporarily to lend my experience to socialists here during things like election campaigns and more generally the explanation and the pursuit of socialist ideas. So yeah, it was, and then I became quite attached to the people and the struggle here, and also on a personal level end up having family here and so on. But it was that in Scotland a new kind of phase of development began to take place where there was a bit of a divergence between the politics of Scotland and England.
That's right.
Where in the 90s you increasingly had a position where, because of things like the experience of the poll tax, on the one hand the fact that the Tories introduced it as almost like a laboratory test on rats, was their attitude by having it early in Scotland for a year, mm-hmm. and then the reaction of the people in Scotland through leadership defying it, including people who had learned from the experience of Liverpool mm-hmm. a couple of years before. So that led to a position where the people of Scotland were more radicalised, more prepared to stand up, increasingly also in favour of some version of home rule or independence to varying extents. And so when I was asked to come and lend a hand and give experience here, initially temporary, like I said, it became permanent. And I've thoroughly enjoyed the fact that there's been a population who do have a rich history, mm-hmm. including in areas like Govan, obviously, in terms of the UCS mm-hmm. Work in, and even before that, way back in 1919, something that I've recently written about, the struggle for a shorter working week without loss of earnings, where places like Govan and all along the river were the nerve centres of that struggle, as was Belfast.
Yeah.
So that background and history and, if you like, consciousness that is still there to some degree, that is rich territory potentially for socialism. The problem has been that there's been all sorts of confusion created by, on the one hand, the retreat by Labour into a capitalist party, the desertion of their traditions in the working class in this country, and then an SNP who talk out of both sides of their mouth, to use one phrase, where, you know, on the one hand they'll try to appear relatively radical, which wasn't different and difficult mm-hmm. compared to Blair-eyed Labour, appear a bit radical to win the working class central belt vote, mm-hmm. and on the other hand reassure the tartan Tories of the North East that they have a new home. Of course, the tartan Tories have returned home recently, which is why Alex Salmond lost his seat.
Unfortunately, yeah.
So the SNP, I think, attempt to be all things to all classes. And that, to me, is totally unacceptable, because society is based on classes and class exploitation. So that's why I'm one of the founding organisers of the Scottish Socialist Party.
And did you think that was what was maybe required was a new vehicle?
Yes, absolutely, because Labour had deserted the territory for socialism. The SNP were beginning to attract some young people who were disaffected and older at the time, in the 90s. And we decided we need a new vehicle. We need an open challenge to these rival big parties and put forward something that combines socialism with the rights of the Scottish people to self-determination and, to be concrete, the idea of an independent socialist Scotland. So that was initially Scottish Militant Labour, then the Scottish Socialist Alliance, and in 1998 we formed it into one unified socialist party, the Scottish Socialist Party. And that's at the core of our DNA. We were for socialism, for working class rights in all sorts of ways, a positive vision of the future, which has things like a decent living minimum wage based on formulas like two-thirds the average work, male worker's wage to close the gender gap and to fight poverty. The idea of a guaranteed minimum working week for all workers that want it. I've pioneered the idea of a minimum 16-hour contract for all workers that want it.
Yeah.
And incidentally got me Union Osdo to adopt that and pioneered within the trade union movement as well.
And you've just became their national representative?
I'm one of the two executive committee members, or executive council is called, for Scotland. I was elected last year, took on that in May last year. And so we argue for things like, you know, decent living minimum wage, guaranteed minimum working week, but also a shorter working week without loss of earnings, including that measure, because it would be an answer to what sometimes is the threat of new technology, which could become a blessing if it was used to shorten the hours of drudgery that many workers, millions of workers suffer, and instead to share out the work and improve workers' lives and give them more time for leisure, to pursue other interests, to learn other things that, for example, I know nothing about and that I'd like to learn, so that you could have a different kind of society altogether. So the SSP stands for that, but also for Scottish self-government, for an independent socialist Scotland, not some kind of tartan-wrapped capitalism, not some kind of mini Westminster where the rich continue to be richer every year and the poor get poorer, which is built into the entire system of capitalism. We want a root and branch change to that, but we think that could be more quickly achieved in an independent Scotland, but also we think independence is a democratic right for the Scottish people as a nation.
Yeah.
And so we combine that into the slogan, the shorthand of an independent socialist Scotland.
Okay. It's that thing, as you say, about having representation. As you say, in the 80s, it was that thing about Thatcher had left or was leaving the legacy.
Yeah.
A lot of it was about individualism.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, I always think in my work here, I see it's hard for people to be individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
Very difficult to be different.
Yeah.
Especially. And I'm thinking that even in your early career, Richard, where a lot of people leave politics to other people.
Aye.
And they wonder why people want to be politicians, as you say, because maybe when you're in the inside, you see a lot of people are making a career out of it.
Yeah.
It's maybe not all about representing their community or their nation, even. But to me, that's the thing about when we move into these technological times, where there's obviously rampant companies, obviously mostly American-based, but they seem to be doing what they want, where they want.
Absolutely.
And to me, that's the thing about, like, a small nation like ourselves, how do we sort of take to deal with these? Because, again, Scotland has still not got its own self-determination, so we're having to deal with the fact that major companies can be leaving here shortly. Obviously, we don't know what the deal or scenario is. But to me, that's a thing about a threat. obviously, they're saying about the existential threat of climate change. And to me, that's as much for a, obviously, that's like a global thing that we all really need to sit and have some sort of meeting about that. But in this sort of local level, as you were saying about the SSP and other parties providing representation for them, to me, that's a thing about yourself and maybe myself. When you grow up, you're not maybe wanting to be better than anybody, you just want a level playing field, however that is. What do you see maybe as being the level playing field now, Richie?
Well, I suppose, referring to one point you made there, Jim, I've never been ambitious for myself. My parents sacrificed and gave up an awful lot and lived in quite severe poverty, to be honest. Yeah. But they sacrificed and slaved away as working people so that I could get a better future, as most people do for their children. An idea of a better education, a better future and so on. And maybe particularly my mother was sometimes a bit disappointed that I didn't turn that into some sort of high-flying career, that I committed myself to the socialist cause. Right. And she probably didn't entirely understand that. My father began to understand it more, because he was more aware, political man in some ways. But without getting bogged down on that personal side, then I've never been personally ambitious to, for example, take up the offer that I did have in my young days to become a councillor with the prospect of becoming a Labour MP. It didn't particularly attract me. For some people, however, the salary did.
Yeah.
And that's where I think if you don't have fixed principles, then you go astray. And one of my fixed principles would be that representatives should also help to create a level playing field by having MSPs or MPs or full-time union officials either living on the same wage as the average skilled worker, which would be a way of keeping them in touch with the people they're supposed to represent, that they're elected to represent, and also obviously elected and accountable and all that. So that would be one of my beliefs, one of my principles. But the level playing field, I think you've got a position now where the world is becoming even more owned by capitalist giants, multinationals. There's probably a couple of hundred of them dominate the world economy, not much more than that. You've got a position where, unfortunately, not just Labour but even the SNP government seem to have this approach of trying to bribe big business into investing in Scotland. I've often described in the past as rattling the begging bowl under the noses of multinationals. Come in, you've got an educated workforce, but we'll not tax you much. And their position on corporation tax, for example, of the ultimate aim of having it at the same level as the south of Ireland, which is 12.5%, even lower than the pittance that they pay in Britain, then that to me is trying to bribe the exploiters. And instead of bribing the exploiters, we should organise society in a way that means we stand on our own feet, and we're quite capable of it. It's a very developed and educated working class in countries like Scotland. There's the, we have the technology, as they said in Star Trek or wherever it was. We have the technology, but what's the technology used for? Is it to displace jobs? I mean, for example, in retail, like I said, I'm one of the, if you like, union elected lay leaders in retail. Then we, just in retail alone, there's calculations and predictions of 1 million jobs being threatened out of the 3 million in retail in Britain by artificial intelligence, robotics and so on. And instead of that being a curse, it could be converted into a blessing. Who wants to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning like I do in order to do that shift? Who wants to have to work long hours? I don't in retail, but who wants to work, you know, beyond 30 hours a week for a decent living? For instance, why not have things like a 4 day week? Why not have things like a 6 hour day when 8 hours pay? Well, the answer to that is that you can't have that if you're trying to provide for profit. The obstacle is one word: profit. And so big business is an obstacle to human progress because they're out for profit, and that's their motive, their whole driving force, their reason for existence. And so I believe that instead of begging big multinationals to come in and invest with bribery, like low taxation rates for them and a highly educated workforce that don't actually get that good a wage, instead of that, we should have public ownership of transport, of energy production, including renewables, to tackle our corner of the climate crisis. We should have free public transport so that people could travel Scotland, get to know it better, have better links with distant members of the family that they could afford to go to, because it'd be free travel.
Yeah.
That would create jobs in the transport system. It would combat the overuse of cars. It would help to overcome some of the pollution. It'd be help to be a solution to pollution, as well as tackling poverty. And why not have that kind of society invest in things like public transport, the jobs that go with it, the technology that goes with it, create decent apprenticeships in the process? Why not have a public energy company that converted into renewable green energy and used what nature has provided, you know, the wind powers, the hydroelectric powers that are available in Scotland, etc., the wave power and all that, which could mean that instead of the workers in the Govan shipyard or anywhere else clinging on by their fingernails to jobs for destruction, for war efforts, etc., instead of that, they could be having jobs for construction, to construct marine technology for green energy production and things such as that, or for the building of ferries to replace the aging fleet that Scotland currently has and needs to replace. There's all sorts of ways of connecting the different parts of the jigsaw and creating a better Scotland, one where you've guaranteed decent jobs, green jobs, if you want to call it that. And I have to be careful in language, obviously, in Scotland, but green jobs, but green in the environmental sense. And, you know, having production for people's needs and not for profit, public ownership of these things, that to me is the way to create a level playing field where everybody has a chance of a decent job, decent future, a decent climate, and a life of greater pleasure and variety, and not just living to work.
A lot of time I've been picking up interesting pieces for the news. There's not a lot of interesting things. A lot of things is just a bit repetition. But I was thinking some commentators have said, why for Brexit did we not hold like a kind of people's council, where the politicians would be involved and the citizens would be involved and would discuss what would, just as you were saying, would outline a future. And then maybe if we outline the future, that would inform or help to construct the deal. We're at a place at the moment where it seems as if there's only one form of deal could possibly be done, or no deal. And yet everybody has different good suggestions to put into that pot. Have you any thoughts on Brexit yourself and how it's going to affect workers' jobs and rights?
Well, there's an old claim that in Ireland, if you ask somebody for directions, they quite often would say, well, I wouldn't start here. And I think that applies to the issue of Brexit, that I wouldn't start here with a Brexit referendum in the first place. That wasn't a genuinely people-driven referendum or choice. It was a binary choice created by faction struggles inside the Tory party and David Cameron's attempt to fend off his own right wing, his kind of Eurosceptic rebels, and his attempt to fend off the advances of UKIP on his right flank. And it backfired, because what they underestimated, he was arrogant enough, like he was over the issue of the Scottish referendum, he was arrogant enough that it was a foregone conclusion. People would vote to remain in the EU. And what he left out of the equation was a couple of things, I suppose. One was the fact that there was such massive disaffection with the political class, with these politicians that never do anything for you, in the most deprived parts, particularly of areas like the north of England, that had been deindustrialised and just totally neglected, and which Labour had neglected and abandoned, as well as the Tory party, who kicked out, used the Brexit referendum as an opportunity to lash out at the political elite, as they saw it, and voted against them and voted to leave. Now, also, both sides, the leadership of both sides of that campaign, actually whipped up a great deal of racist, vicious, xenophobic nonsense, which added to the equation and the mix. So I wouldn't have started with a referendum on the EU membership in the first place, but it happened. And the outcome was to vote to leave. But I think then there was a mistake in Scotland where some, such as Nicola Sturgeon initially, tried to tie the two things together in terms of independence and Brexit. I argued from the outset that they should be decoupled, that what you needed was to have the merits and case for Scottish independence on its own grounds. Mm-hmm. And then if you won the Scottish referendum for independence, then have a sensible, rational debate about what relationship to Europe, the EU included. And actually, I think what Brexit does, it highlights that once again the Scottish people vote one way, 62% voted to remain, but because we're part of Britain, we go another way, leaving the EU, which does not mean that I'm, or the SSP, some kind of fan club for the European Union. Mm-hmm. European Union was set up originally as a common market for big business. It's an anti-democratic body, let alone undemocratic. It's against a lot of workers' interests. It's against the right to public ownership. It tries to dictate privatisation of services, all sorts of other measures. And in the past, it was seen as a kind of dented shield, to use a Neil Kinnock phrase in a different context. It was seen as a kind of a dented shield by some workers in the trade union movement, because Thatcherism was rampant in Britain. But then I think what's happened is that the European Union has become Thatcherite, to put in shorthand, and worse, actually, in terms of the far right becoming such an influence in a lot of European nations. So the European Union is no escape route for the people, the working class people of Scotland, but neither is a capitalist Britain. So I think it highlights the need for an independent Scotland, an independent socialist Scotland, which then could build relationships and alliances with other peoples, and ultimately aim at an independent socialist Scotland and an alliance of socialist democracies across Europe. That's the bigger vision I would have for the future. In the short term, I think we have to mostly prepare for an assault on working class people's rights and our services after Brexit. I think that's what we need to prepare for. And I raised at our Osdo Union executive 2 days ago the idea that maybe we need to start preparing through the wider trade union movement for the theme of we won't pay for the Brexit crisis. Because I think we're going to pay in terms of it being an excuse for job losses. It's not necessarily the cause, it's an excuse. An excuse for further attacks on workplace rights. An excuse for example, deregulation of food hygiene standards. An excuse to sell lumps of the health service to American big business, which was already threatened previously through that TTIP trading idea. So there's all sorts of threats arising from the Brexit scenario, because nobody at the negotiating table represents the working class. It's rival factions of big business on a European and a British scale. That's who's involved in the talks. So I don't see any solution to our benefit coming from either of those camps or clashing negotiators. So I think really what we need to do is start to organise our own, if you like, I wouldn't necessarily call it a People's Assembly. We need to start organising our own forums of the trade union movement, community organisations, people on the left, to start saying, we're not going to pay the price of this. We want instead to carve out a new future. And, for example, the exit from, assuming that happens, although there's at least a possibility now, I think, of Brexit not going ahead. But without getting bogged down in the minutiae of that, that if Brexit occurs, there's no excuse anymore, for instance, for the Scottish Government to say, we can't bring all the ferries and the railways into public ownership because the European Union dictates otherwise. No, you don't have that shield anymore, that smokescreen. Carry out public ownership of things like transport, amongst others. And you don't even have to say to hell with the regulations of the European Union anymore. Let's use it as a positive opening to bring forward the change that will benefit working class people.
You're a published author as well. You have one book here I'm looking at, Break the Chains, and also a number of other pamphlets, including one you've just showed me about the 1919 revolt here and Class Not Creed. What will people pick up from that, Richie?
I suppose, apart from the fact they'll discover I'm an absolutely fantastic writer, obviously, which goes without saying, I hope I've just said it. No, seriously, what they should pick up from them is an explanation in hopefully common, plain but colourful language
mm-hmm.
of different events and issues that affect ordinary people. Break the Chains is primarily on the issue of how and why capitalism exploits, how working class people can escape exploitation and poverty wages and insecure work so long as that system remains mm-hmm. in office, so to speak. And then puts forward a positive vision, rooted mostly in Scotland, but also with all sorts of international examples
yeah.
of a programme of socialist change, starting with issues of minimum wage, guaranteed hours, expansion of the health service, free public transport, house building programme to meet the emergency crisis housing mm. situation we face, and so on. It's an attempt to paint a vision in 21st century Scotland of what socialism could mean in the language of jobs, bricks, mortar, services and workers' rights as well,
yeah.
and the issues of the environment. But it's done in a way with anecdotes from workers' rail struggles, references to historical battles, and tries to also apply socialist theory in a fashion that people can understand without jargon.
Yeah.
That's what I've tried to do, and yeah. that's the biggest of the writings I've done. The others, I mean, Clasnock Creed refers to the period of 1968 in Northern Ireland and the theme that what we need is workers' unity and socialism,
mm-hmm.
not a sectarian headcount in yeah. elections between orange and green parties,
yeah.
neither of whom have done anything to solve the problems and to equalise the rights of people in Ireland, frankly, and where they're quite prepared to come together into what amounts to a coalition arrangement in the power sharing executive,
mm.
and that is the DUP, the orange bigots that that party represent, and Sinn Féin, who have been quite prepared to come together and unite on things like cutting corporation tax levels, on things like austerity measures been passed on from the cuts from Westminster, privatisation measures, and also rampant corruption,
mm-hmm.
which has currently been exposed day by day in the public inquiry into the so-called renewable heat initiative.
Yeah,
rather, where
obviously it's something we know about here in
yeah,
Scotland, but we
yeah.
don't know maybe the ramifications, and that's maybe part of it, and that's why I was interested in you coming in, Richard, because the media has obviously been full of Brexit.
Aye.
On a couple of years now, but to me that's the thing, it's drowning out voices like yourself,
yeah, yeah.
And not a lot of time is given to socialism and,
yeah.
and its principles and its
exactly.
direction of travel, and so people are thinking it's just inevitable that we have to follow the flow,
yeah.
And as you know, obviously with and even our own experiences of Jeremy Corbyn mm. coming to govern, where we weren't allowed to talk to him even though
no,
we were
aye.
Standing within 6 feet of him. So you didn't have that kind of informal chat
yeah.
you'd maybe have with somebody. Maybe if you're doing an interview, it's a kind of formal thing. But when you're standing next to somebody, you can just shoot the breeze.
That's right.
But you maybe gain something through that small contact. And to me, that's the thing about representation. We're just dealing with this thing, and then we're dealing with the existential crises in other parties.
Uh-huh.
That's the other thing. We've actually not been discussing people and
yeah.
their issues for a long time.
Yeah.
And as you say, in the representation of your workers and USDA, that's a thing where you don't know who's next.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
whole swathes of the high streets in the UK are just moving. Hopefully some of them will take on the challenge, as some of the big supermarkets have been
mm-hmm.
slow to do, but to go online.
Yeah.
But again, as you were saying, about that thing about a big company coming in and cutting our company up and,
yeah.
and taking them out of the game. To me, that's the thing about like good jobs,
mm-hmm.
as you say. There is an opportunity, I believe, at the moment to create better jobs because
right.
of the technology that is available. But as you say, it could be that somebody else is the idea of the kind of divide and rule principle.
Uh-huh.
If we make some people unemployed, then that makes everybody willing to accept lower standards.
That's right. And I think in terms of your mention there about the messages that come across, there's increased control of what people hear about. There's more and more centralisation of it, which is a bit of a paradox considering you've got things like the internet.
Yeah.
But actually, in terms of media, with the honourable exceptions of the likes of Sonny G, then you've got this monopolisation of media, you've got the monopolisation of message, you've got the convergence of ideologies between the major parties, where they're much of a muchness.
Yeah.
It's Tweedledum and Tweedledee and Tweedledummer.
Aye.
And you get that problem where a radical socialist voice is drowned out, and certainly Brexit, the noise around Brexit. I've said recently that you know, there's the old cynical expression, it's a good day for bad news. Well, mm-hmm. It's been a good day, a good couple of years for bad news.
Yeah.
Because the meantime are shafting people through attacks on benefits, benefit sanctions, universal credit. They're attacking workers' rights with for their anti-union laws and so on.
Yeah.
Cutting back services. And meantime, everybody's deafened by the indecipherable noise about Brexit and all these manoeuvres in Parliament that nobody understands.
Yeah.
So I think we have to just try and get down onto ground level, grassroots level, of explaining on the street corners and in the workplaces and so on, and in local independent radios, etc., the fact that there's a totally different vision and a totally different message
mm-hmm.
out there
yeah.
that people need to try and hear about, and empower people through that, by the fact that you could have decent jobs. There's no need or excuse for Tesco's, the biggest of the supermarkets, slashing 9,000 jobs in their plans. There's no excuse for it. They've had 12 successive quarters of increased growth.
Yeah.
Their chief executive increased his salary last year by 17.5%. He's now on 4.9 million.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's for the boss of a company where workers are on rather modest wages, not that much above the minimum wage. And so I think we need to start using our collective muscle
mm-hmm.
as an organised workforce to resist that kind of thing, but also lift people's morale
mm-hmm.
and belief, self-belief, by giving them a vision of how it could be different, of how you could have a shorter working week without loss of earnings, how you could easily afford that, how you could have the use of new technology to help do that, and so on. And that's why I wrote the stuff recently about the 1919 revolt, because that was the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Those workers in Govan, in Partick, in Clydebank, in other parts of Clydeside, and over in Belfast, they came out on mass strikes, 100,000 in Clydeside, 60,000 in Belfast, united Protestants mm-hmm. and Catholics,
yeah.
majority Protestant workforce, a Catholic elected consciously as the chairman of the strike committee. They came out on strike at that time 100 years ago for a shorter working week without loss of pay, partly because they were working terrible hours of drudgery, 54 hours was the norm,
right.
and sometimes more than that during the war, and also to mop up the mass unemployment that was going to be added to by the soldiers demob from the slaughter of the First World War.
Yeah.
So that should be an inspiration to people if they knew about that kind of history, but it's buried deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have most to lose from a united working class getting up on his hind legs and fighting back are the ones that bury our history. We know that locally as well as globally. And so I'm not saying I can overcome that on my own, but it's a modest contribution to trying to make people more aware of their own roots, their own history, and the fact that people, predecessors, have fought and sometimes won concessions.
Yeah.
And that they were on the verge of actually having control of Glasgow and of Belfast at the time, the workers were. And that's the kind of thing that I think needs to be more made aware of, to make sure that people don't think there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, where can we find these publications, Richie?
Probably the best route is to go to the Scottish Socialist Party website.
Yeah.
And that'll lead you to online shopping facility. Either that or get in touch with me on Facebook, and it can be arranged to get copies of them.
Excellent. Richard, I want to thank you for spending time with us and giving us your thoughts.
It's a pleasure.
Hopefully this is the first and not the last time you'll be here.
Definitely.
So
pleasure.
More power to you.
Good luck to you. Thanks.